Hola, queridas, queridos. Welcome back to the Beam and Flow podcast, a nitty-gritty exploration of your body, energy, awareness, movement, and flow. I am your host, Chloe Cofresi. Here we go. Enjoy the show. Okay, so we are diving into the episode with Dr. Jolene Brighton, and I am so excited to share this one with you. A little background. So I met Dr. Brighton 4 years ago in 2019 at Collective in Manhattan, and I was producing a book signing event for her, a book launch event for Beyond the Pill when that came out. And that book profoundly affected me. We talk a little bit about it in this episode. And Dr. Brighton and I have stayed connected through social media, through email. And I was just so thrilled when I found out that she had this new book coming out. And it's everything that I wanted to know, that I didn't even know that I wanted to know when I was a teenager, when I was in my 20s, about my body, about sexuality, about what's normal. The book is called Is This Normal? And I think you're going to get a lot out of it. This is one that you're going to want to share with your friends, with your sisters, with your cousins, with your mom. It's going to start some conversations. So we get into, what is my orgasm normal? Is my libido normal? What about how women's health is the state of women's health in the U.S. specifically, specifically with Latina and melanated women? Like, what is it like to be in these bodies and to be looking for healthcare and for medical advice and not be able to find it? All of these things we get into. So without further ado, here we go with Dr. Brighton. Well, let's dive in, because I have so much that I want to talk to you about with this book. Yeah. Is This Normal? I loved the book. Loved it. It is definitely the book that I wish I had when I was a teenager, and even in my 20s. I mean, the sad truth for me, and I think for a lot of women that you have seen and that your book reaches, is that a lot of us didn't even start talking or thinking about our hormones until our 30s. Mm-hmm. We were just expressing hormonal issues and being told, oh, that's a problem, here's a fix.
Yeah.
And that's it. There was no explanation of what was actually going on. So your book came about Beyond the Pill at a really pivotal time for me. I had already come off of birth control, but there was so much that I was experiencing in my body that I had never experienced before, because I had never had an unmedicated cycle. I
knew,
as right? an adult.
It's like, do I want to say natural, but I don't want people to feel bad if they're
right,
on birth
exactly.
control. But yeah, I mean, you can't have a cycle while you're on the pill or other hormones that shut down your ovulation. So it's not a cycle, but it's a medicated state of being for sure. And it's one of those things that when you come off, it's like, who am I now? Who is this person? Like, there's not just like, who am I psychologically, but like, who am I as my menstrual self? Like, as I cycle, like, what is this body now?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I was experiencing all of that when Beyond the Pill came out, and all of a sudden I thought, oh, there's a reason. Like, here's the science behind all of this stuff that I've been intuiting in my body, but I didn't have the words for. And you mentioned some stats in your book, but I really want to get into a little bit more how these numbers really affect Latinas, Black women, women of color, mm-hmm. because it's torturous in a lot of ways for women in general, the yeah. experience of giving birth. But there's this whole other aspect to it that I don't think is talked about much. And I would just love to hear your perspective as a provider, and as a mother yourself, what that has been for you.
Yeah, well, I have structured my life very differently after my son, my oldest, had developed PANDAS, which is an autoimmune condition that affects the brain. I make it sound really benign. You lose your child overnight. Like, they just are gone. They're vacant in their own body. And you just have a I mean, for lack of a better, like the way it feels is just a violently psychotic individual living in your home. and fortunately, we've got him into remission. But so I had to restructure everything. And in that moment, you know, I was running three full-time clinics. Like I had providers under me, but it all came on me. Like how could my, one, I am the doctor in the family, but also like when my son got sick, I became the caretaker. And that became very difficult because I was like simultaneously, like I was the main source of income for our family. And my, but it's just not a situation. So let me just be clear to people. Like I was a caretaker. I was a working mom. It's funny that we say working mom. Like I was just a parent who had a job because there's lots of dads out there, working dads, if you will. But with pandas, like you can't leave one person to it all day. It's a very difficult situation. I had to restructure my entire life around that. And it really gave me so much perspective on like, you know, just in having that experience, like single mothers, how, and as you were saying, like the cost of birth. So we talked, there's obstetric violence. Obstetrical violence impacts women of color at a very high rate. If you're Black, it's the worst. Your mortality rate is much higher. Providers treat you much worse. This is all documented in the research. And what nobody has really talked about is how Hispanic women, their birth outcomes became so bad during the pandemic. And there's still research pending to come in. So there's the whole component of it's dangerous. It's dangerous to give birth in the United States if you're a woman of color. And then there's the after the fact, like trying to work and be a mother and the way that society just isn't there to hold you like it is in other countries. And I think that's something that we're sold this American dream, as I talk to you and you're living in Mexico, but we're sold this American dream. And people are starting to wake up to the reality that there are societies out there that do support mothers, who value their contributions, who value that they are the caretakers of the future of their society. And that just doesn't really exist in the United States.
I really agree with you. And I think there's a psychological shift happening amongst my peers, women in their 30s, early 40s, that is sort of a reckoning for this kind of lie that we've been sold of what it is to be a mother, what's expected of us, what it is to be a woman, to receive medical care, all of it, to know what your cycle is even. And I think for a lot of us, we kind of believed that, this maternal thing is just something that I'll always have access to no matter what. Like there's no questioning it. And we've been sold a lifestyle and medication that actually strips that away from us. And then we wake up in our 30s and we're like, oh, wait, there's a reason why I'm depressed and anxious and I have low libido and now I'm trying to conceive and I'm having all these issues. No one told me. No one told me. And so I think there is a look to other countries, to other societies as to how we treat motherhood. And it was kind of put on the back burner, I think, in the States for the last 50 years. And there's a lot of different expressions of what that could look like. But I think medically, it's been my experience and the experience of my peers that your cycle and motherhood were things to be afraid of, right? Yeah. They were things to suppress. And I'm curious as to what, as a provider, it has looked like for you to see your patients like tap into the power that their cycles actually hold to heal them, to bring relief to symptoms that they were told were incurable. Like I see you as this really, in this really beautiful place as a space holder or a truth keeper, right? There's this information that we desperately need. And it feels so validating to have it from someone who's one of us and also one of them. you know, like yeah. you cross both lines. And that for me, that's such a comfort. And so I would love to hear how you've experienced it in your own practice, in your own life.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's actually just all of my girlfriends where I live, like we all got together. They read my book. They were like, we're going to do a book club. It literally turned into like a 4-hour, like hormone education session with women in their, you know, 40s and even later on talking about their body, about hormones, and feeling really embarrassed and ashamed at how little they actually knew. They read, is this normal? And they're like, how did I not know all of this? And see, it was so interesting because there were really tear-filled moments of women realizing like menopause is coming and I just now am understanding my body. And now it's going to do something totally new and I don't understand it. And that was really powerful for me because when I was on birth control pills for 10 years, first generation college student, went all the way to being a doctor, like lots of things I can say are like, were amazing about birth control. But if you read my book, Beyond the Pill, you also know all the side effects, my raginess, my vagina problems. Like I had a lot of side effects on the pill and I was gaslit and dismissed. And I was always taught, not just from my parents, but from society as a whole, that my periods and my cycles and my hormones, they were one, only necessary if you want a baby, and two, really the bane of my existence. And it was when I got off the pill and I lost my period. I remember just being like, whoa, like I took this for granted. Now it's gone. And I had been even thinking at the time, I don't even want to be a mom. And then when I lost my period altogether and I was like, oh my God, wait a minute, but I might not be able to be a mom. And that really sets the conversation very differently. But once I got my cycle back and I started tracking and really understanding hormones more, I started to see the superpowers that it was giving me. And I remember being, you know, I was like in my late 20s, but just really looking at like, oh, wow, like I might only have like 15 more years, maybe 20 more years of cycling. Like I lost 10 years of this. And that was not something I expected, to come off the pill and mourn that I didn't have those 10 years of leveraging those superpowers. Now, I got on the pill because my periods were like wicked heavy and super, super painful to the point that the doctor was like, maybe you have endometriosis, maybe you don't, but we're not going to do anything to test. And I did hate my period at that point. But in retrospect, I'm like, man, I really missed out on all of that. And the, you know, what I shared, what just happened, literally that was like 2 nights ago that I was in that conversation, is the same thing that happens in my practice. And then I hear from women online on social media who are like, I was sold a bill of goods. I was told my body was betraying me with all these symptoms. And as it turns out, like, this is my bestie. Like, my body's here with me. It's not here. And even if you think about the way that pharmaceuticals, and we are one of the only countries in the world, there's one other, who allows these, not just pharmaceutical ads, but man, these are intense ads. The way they frame things, the imagery that they show of like, you just can't be normal in a normally functioning body. And I use that, you know, normal is a range. It's a spectrum, as I talk about in my book. But the real narrative is like, as a woman, you can't just be okay unless you've got these interventions. And those interventions might be birth control pill, like I just talked about, or it might be something like douching. Like there's always something that we're just not good enough on our own and we need some kind of intervention.
Yeah. And I love that you're speaking to that because I feel that and I have felt that so strongly throughout my life. Mm-hmm. Watching commercials as a young girl and thinking, is there just something inherently wrong? Like, am I supposed to be punished just for the body that I was born into and that half the population is born into? Like,
yeah,
everyone's born from. I mean, and there was, so there's always been a curiosity for me as to how things used to be or were done in the past. And I felt growing up like that was forbidden knowledge. Like I wasn't supposed to know that there was another way to think about your period. And I'm curious, as when you were writing Is This Normal, what was, you say that the most questions, or the biggest arena that the questions came from was around sex and around libido. So what would you say is the biggest, is this normal question around sexuality that you've seen?
Is my libido normal? Is definitely one of the tops. And then, are my orgasms normal? And what's very interesting is I actually wasn't familiar with the research until I wrote the book. That's what people want to know. They want to know about their libido. It's number one. And it is what they want to know. They want to know about their orgasms as well, because these are two things, especially for women, that we're not supposed to talk about. Or if we do talk about it, it's like in a comical sense, or it's in the media where it's like women are just not interested in sex, and like, oh, she's always like, not now, honey, I have a headache. Like that's what's normal, is women don't want sex and a woman cannot orgasm. It is a mystery. It is so difficult. Like you're more likely to find a unicorn in the forest, and then instead of like making a woman have an orgasm during a sexual encounter. And these are all false. There are, and anybody who's living in their body knows on an intuitive level that it is false, but it is very difficult to hold on to that, to your knowing, your inner knowing, when you are inundated with these messages time and time again. And in the chat, so I have a whole chapter on libido, and I break down the hormone component of what is going on with our hormones, because there are lots of people out there that are like, it's your hormone, it's just your testosterone. And I'm like, spoiler, estrogen plays a really big role here, as does thyroid and as does insulin. And then there are people who are like, it has nothing to do with your hormones. It's just all this psychological aspect and this way of being. And there is some truth to that as well. What I often find is that it's usually a mixture of things, because if there are things going on psychologically, so maybe there's relationship issues, body image factors going on. I mean, that's another one of like, try being in our society and loving yourself unapologetically and being comfortable in your own skin, when again, we're told all the time, it's not good enough in some way. But, you know, it could be these psychological issues. And at the same time, the way the psychological issues, our relationship issues affect us can weigh on our hormones. Our hormones are chemical messengers who are conveying what's happening in the environment and orchestrating a response so that we have physiological adaptations. And so if the outside is stressful, it is not a good time to have a baby for whatever reason, then your hormones are going to shift. They are like, reproduction is expensive. Having a baby, maxing out my account, and I'm already depleted, not going to happen. And if you're listening to this and you're like, but I don't want a baby, your ovaries don't care. Your uterus doesn't care. Your body is driven to have this cycle. The goal is ovulation. When we menstruate is because we failed to become pregnant, and maybe on purpose, maybe not on purpose, maybe frustratingly so, not on purpose. And that's why we get a period. But we're always taught from the perspective of like, oh, you get a period and then you ovulate. False. We ovulate, then we get a period. And ovulation is energetically demanding, and it also puts us in a more vulnerable state should we become pregnant. So if the signals in the outside environment are not saying this is a good time to have a baby, that's going to affect your hormones. And it's not that you're broken. If your hormones are shifting in response to stress, your libido is downgraded, you're not ovulating regularly, like that's exactly what your body is designed to do. And so our question at that point is, what are these signals and how do we shift them? And sometimes, like in the case of libido, sometimes it is relationship issues. Sometimes it's that you've got gut dysbiosis and inflammation happening in your gut. And so because of that inflammation, you need to bring up your cortisol levels. And because your cortisol levels are coming up, now the brain is like, no, to the progesterone. And progesterone is coming after ovulation. And that is one of the pregnancy hormones that we have. And that whole shift will feel, you know, when your cortisol is up too much, you can feel wired, you can feel tense, you can have trouble sleeping, you might notice belly fat. You're like, stress is getting me and I get sick all the time kind of vibes. And then your progesterone's down. Now you're like, no, I definitely can't sleep at night. Now I'm feeling anxious. I'm finding that my periods are getting heavier. They're more awful. My PMS is worse. When we have all those symptoms, it's really easy to be like, this cargo, this vessel is just broken and something's wrong. But what's really happened is it's shifted with your survival in mind and at the expense sometimes of your sexual health.
So you mentioned how if outside is not where it's a safe place to conceive, then you're not going to ovulate or you might have issues with ovulation, right? So mm-hmm. would it be fair to say that I have some friends who they're like, well, I don't PMS symptoms. Sure. I have those, but I get like obnoxiously frustrated around yeah. ovulation. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there's something to that in response to what you're saying, like, is the body perhaps saying like, okay, outside is so off that during ovulation, where most of us think, oh, ovulation, I'm going to be super horny. I'm going to be like flirty. I want to go out and dance.
Yeah.
And that's the way it should be. And I'm over here feeling like, just give me my potato chips and my TV and leave me alone.
Yeah.
So is there something, is that a sign then that the body is saying, yeah, we're not ovulating the way that we could or should be because X, Y, or Z is affecting us?
Well, what's interesting is that there are small studies. We need to replicate these. We need to get larger studies that show that when estrogen goes high, we can be more critical of our partner, more critical of people around us. And so prior to ovulating, estrogen spikes. It is possible that estrogen is going too high, or more likely we're having clearance issues going on. As we pass ovulation, we will start to produce progesterone. Maybe we don't get our progesterone levels up to the level that they need to be. And then that can leave estrogen up even further. So those are definite times that you can see that. The other thing is that around ovulation, testosterone also rises. And testosterone, the way I like to talk about it is that, so for people who are not aware, the female body is always regarded as being like, oh, estrogen is the woman hormone and testosterone, that's the man hormone, except that our bodies have lots of testosterone. In fact, more testosterone than estrogen. It's just how we utilize it. And the way that I like people to understand testosterone is not just a libido hormone. It's also involved in your immune system. It's involved in your bone health. It's also involved in your mental health. So when testosterone is right, we will set boundaries. We will feel like we will kick ass. We will be motivated. We will be like standing in our power, like, yes, like I'm on top of this. And that's one of the superpowers it gives us in harmony with these other ones. I don't want anyone to be like, I just need more testosterone. Maybe I got a whole questionnaire in my book to help you understand that. But with testosterone also, if you are in a situation that maybe isn't in alignment with you, you have been putting up with too much, that testosterone comes up and you're just like, boundaries, but maybe you weren't given the tools for how to execute on boundaries. And so in those situations, sometimes it looks like shutting down. Sometimes it looks like, you know, lashing out. So testosterone going high can, if it's really high, it can definitely make people rage. But when it's up, you can feel a little more ragey and be a little short with people as well. And so it can be several things going on during that time of the month and around ovulation. The other thing I'll say, and I'll just like throw another thing on there. People are gonna be like, it's so complicated. You will figure it out. If you get the book and read through it, you will figure this out. But in the book, I talk about the period flu. And this is when some people feel like they get the flu before their period. And that is because of inflammation, estrogen, and histamine. And histamine will make you angry in the brain. Histamine won't want to be around people. And if you're inflamed and you have any kind of inflammation, the brain can definitely shift. And some people get sad and some people get mad. And some people get like I just have to shut down, like I was saying before. And so that's also something that can happen when estrogen's rising during that time. And so there are lots of things that we can do. It just depends on what exactly is going on. But I'm glad you bring that up, because everybody talks about the issues that can come up in the late luteal phase, so that's the PMS phase. And not a lot of people talk about the fact that ovulation isn't always sunshine and rainbows and unicorns for everybody, like we're told it's going to be. It's the same thing though with progesterone in some brains. So the average person's going to have progesterone and be like, this is so lovely. I shouldn't say the average person. The neurotypical person is what we understand. It's going to feel so great with progesterone. The neurodivergent individual may feel bliss and amazing, and this is the best hormone ever, or they may find that they feel really aggravated, depressed, like they're having more of a paradoxical response to progesterone. And so I say all of this, I'm not saying like, oh, you're definitely autistic if like you're that person, but it's important to recognize that these are areas that medicine hasn't even explored, neurodivergent minds of women. They still are like, the diagnostic criteria is based on little boys, and you're not this acting the same way as a little boy. And it's like, well, duh, yeah, I'm a 40-year-old woman. Why would I be acting the same as a little boy? Like, my prefrontal cortex is, it's formed. I've learned like not to do certain things. So we're really bad at diagnosing all of that and understanding that in women. And then there's the interplay of hormones with all of this. So this is something else I talk about in my book, is the PMDD association, which is a very, very extreme form of PMS. Extreme in the sense that it is much longer, much more severe. There can be suicidal ideation. There can be like severe depression and severe physiological symptoms. And it is much higher among those who are neurodivergent. And so I say all of this because you might notice cyclical times where things are much worse. But what I always say to my patients who get like a PMDD diagnosis is, you know, how's the rest of your cycle? And if they're finding that other times when hormones are changing, there's also major issues, or throughout the cycle, there is, you know, it's like, I'm always having like issues with noise, like always, like, or, oh God, tags and socks, like the way they touch me, like these sensory issues are always there, or these executive function issues are always there, but they really ramp up right before your period. Well, friend, you may have just gotten one diagnosis, but in fact, there's something else at the root of that. And this is where I'd really love to see medicine take off in more of an exploration before my time is done, this go around on the planet. That would be lovely.
I would love that too. that would be very lovely. I want to go back to the quiz that you mentioned in this normal, is this normal? So I took the quiz. And I was all excited because I healed so many of my hormone issues. I was like, I'm not going to be any of these. I'm so excited to take this quiz. And sure enough, I think while I may have healed most of them, there might be something with this low cortisol thing. And mm-hmm. I had never even considered low cortisol a thing. Like I didn't even realize that that could be an issue. So I would love to, if you're okay, to like give you a quick rundown of what I'm thinking, because I think a lot of women would be surprised to think of low cortisol as something that they might be struggling with hormonally. So I have been finding that I'm getting more of the afternoon tired than mm-hmm. I used to. I have been struggling with night sweats for like 10 years at least. And I've done.
And how old are you?
I'm 37.
Okay.
And I was on birth control from 18 to 30. So I eat super clean. I change what I'm eating each week based on my cycle. I drink a ton of water. I don't even really, if I have caffeine or alcohol, it's when I'm ovulating. Like I'm really on the food front. I think I'm doing everything that I can. I'm sleeping enough, right? Like, and I'm also, I think this is important. I see a functional medicine doctor. And so we've been working for a long time to kind of get my progesterone up so that my my bleed would just be a little bit more of a bleed and less just spotting, and we're mm-hmm. there. But because of that, I'm supplementing with bioidentical progesterone and have been for mm-hmm. probably 2 years or a year and a half. And it's really more of the like still intermittently struggling with the fatigue and the night sweats. Like those are, and I also have low blood pressure and can pass out really easily. And all of those things mm-hmm. seem to be similar to what I was seeing on the questionnaire is this normal? So, mm-hmm. If I was presenting to you, what other questions would you have for me?
Yeah. I mean, so there's like so many things that come up in the differential, like, is this without seeing your labs, like when we're starting to fail in producing progesterone, let me back this whole thing up so people understand. Let's back it up. Okay. 45 is an acceptable age to enter menopause. 35 is an acceptable age to start perimenopause. Now, not everybody's going to start then. We know that the average woman's going to go through menopause about 51 and start perimenopause 45. But it is important to recognize that starting in our mid-30s, we can have hot flashes, night sweats. I will say anytime there is ongoing night sweats, we start thinking about things like, and I'm not saying this is true for you, but just for people to understand, like one end of the spectrum is like cancer, big scary. If you were meeting with a doctor, they should always be running big scaries in their mind. Could this be big scary things? I don't know. I don't want to put it in people's head that like, oh, we need to be afraid of things, but that's just the way I think of them as like big, scary things. Like, you know, could this be cancer? Could this be tuberculosis? Like, could this be something else that's causing this kind of sweating? Is it infectious? So I talked about tuberculosis, but Epstein-Barr virus is another one that sometimes people are sweating a lot. They're having issues. Or is this a hormonal issue? And it could be related to cortisol, but if we're having sweating, and it's starting at 35 every night, it could potentially be signs of perimenopause. That is really extreme perimenopausal to start at 35, to have that degree of sweating, but it is certainly possible. So then we start to ask the question, like, because perimenopause is not a like, oh yeah, this is just perimenopause kind of diagnosis. We start to ask the question of like, well, if we're not getting enough progesterone, is that because the ovary is starting to fail? Maybe we're going into primary ovarian insufficiency. If we're not getting enough progesterone, could this actually be a thyroid issue? And so we start asking questions because the thyroid is involved in follicular maturation. So the follicles, that will be the egg that gets ovulated. So I explain all of this in the book that when you start in the follicular phase, so as you're still bleeding, the ovaries are getting an egg ready. Several. It chooses one, says this is the best one, and that's what gets ovulated. So when it comes to thyroid health, that's crucial for that development and for progesterone production. And then funny enough, you need progesterone to utilize thyroid hormone. They always go together like this. So that's another question we start thinking about. We also start thinking about things like, okay, well, you know, could there be underlying insulin dysregulation taking place? That's something that we always need to have on our mind, because even if your diet is dialed in and great, it's not to say that you might not have an underlying autoimmune condition. That one could be affecting your thyroid or could be affecting your pancreas. And so we can start to see like afternoon dips. We would want to do testing, right? Because is it adrenals or is it after we eat? Maybe we have more carbs and now our blood sugar, we're having dysregulation and now we're seeing that go down. So I hope I'm painting a picture for everyone that like, there's a lot of things that need to be considered. This is why I always tell people like, don't take medical advice from people online. Like there's sometimes well-meaning people who are like, just do this. And I'm like, but that person doesn't know what they don't know. And we have to ask a lot of questions about like, what is going on? When I see patients, I'm like, I want to know what was it like when your mom was pregnant with you? Like, I want to go back there. What do you know about your grandma's health? Like, I want to know your entire history and your family history, because whatever your grandma was doing affected the egg that eventually became you. And whatever your mom was doing definitely affected you and your ovarian function. And then there's the, where did we grow up? And how was our childhood? Because these other things as well, when you're talking about low cortisol, it's really easy to jump at, like, the easiest things is like, oh, maybe we have an infection. Maybe we have long-term stress. Like, maybe. But what if it's childhood trauma? What if you have high ACE scores, adverse childhood events? What if there is this past history of trauma? We could have PTSD. We could have something psychological going on that's affecting our stress response, keeping us in that sympathetic state. And this is what's important for people to understand about low cortisol, is that there is no true low cortisol production from the adrenal glands unless you have an autoimmune disease called Addison's disease. And that is where you can have blood pressure crashes for sure. This is something that very few people have, though. It's a very rare condition. JFK had it. so there are some well-known people who have had it, but that doesn't make it more common. What is more common when it comes to seeing low cortisol is that the brain and the adrenal glands are not speaking in the way that they should. We've been in too high of cortisol for too long, and now the body's adapted to either taking cortisol into cortisone, inactivating it, or blunting receptors. So every hormone has to dock onto a receptor. So instead, it blunts the receptors and says, we can't accept this cortisol, because cortisol is a good thing until you got too much of it. And it's very, very damaging, like destroying brain cells, damaging, destroying cells altogether, damaging. So your body is like, let's downregulate the production the active form of this. Let's downregulate the active form of this. Let's keep it inactive, or let's start blunting receptors. And so it starts making all of these changes to keep you safe. And that can come about, and like I said, it can be past traumas, psychological issues that really haven't gone resolved. And I say this like as if like, can they ever get resolved sometimes? Because some of these things are very deep-seated, and we spend our life journey trying to heal and undo things. And I take that weight very heavily as a mother, that I'm like, my children should not have to spend their child, the rest of their life trying to undo things that were done. And for anybody that's there in that state, like I want to honor you and say that I see you. And I know like it is so much easier to heal your gut than it is to really work on that emotional body and to get space for that. So that's some of the things that we consider with low cortisol. That's why we often see low cortisol going on, is that, that whole mechanism I talked about your body trying to keep you safe. And it is not a time for anybody listening to go jump on like adrenal glands that are all ground up and consume those, which is, I also see a lot of people online recommending that. And I'm like, so you basically will say, I know my car is on empty, but let me just like put the pedal to the metal. There's a little bit of gas there. And let's just burn it out as fast as we can and see what happens. And then the whole thing seizes, and it is so much more work at the mechanic, right, to make this thing go again than it would have been to just say, you know what, we need to slow down, go get some gas, recharge, refuel, and take it slow.
I'm so grateful that you said that, because I have had, not my current doctor, but I've had doctors in the past who say, oh, it's a cortisol thing. It must be your adrenals. Like we should get your adrenals working better, and offer some sort of intervention adrenally. But intuitively, I knew that that wasn't it. Like, mm-hmm. So what you're saying totally tracks, and that makes sense. I also think it's really important to highlight what you said about sometimes it's a lifelong ongoing process of healing. Like there's no, you come to a spot and all of a sudden now you graduate and you're healed and your hormones are all good and your brain functioning is exactly as it should be. And I think that goes too with other hormonal issues that we see a lot, endometriosis, PCOS, things that we've been told are incurable. And I'm definitely not going to say that that's not true. I think there's some medical truth to the fact that you have these cells and there will always be these cells to deal with, right? Or mm-hmm. to reckon with. I'm talking more about endometriosis in this case. But I do think that there's there's absolutely remission that can happen, and there's relief from symptoms that can happen. And what I'm speaking from personal experience with endo, it can feel sometimes like you get to this, you get through a stretch of like, oh, I've gone a year without any endo pain, or I've gone however long, and my cycles are great, and I'm feeling so wonderful. And then all of a sudden you get one cycle where you get stabbing pain midway through, mm-hmm. and you're like, damn it, now.
And then, what did I do?
What did I do? Exactly.
Like, life is so, it should be so much easier than it is. And that is something, so right there, I'm like, this is why we don't take advice from people on the internet, is because you had endo, and I didn't know that you had endo, and that was part of it. And so endo is inflammatory. For people who don't know, endometriosis, people like to say, oh, it's like the cells of your uterus or just somewhere else. They're similar tissues, but they definitely have, I mean, they respond to hormones in the same way, but they have their own characteristics. And it leads to lesions because it bleeds cyclically, like your uterine lining does. And when that happens, the immune system has to come in and clean it up. That's ongoing inflammation. And there's a lot of research to point towards it being an autoimmune condition. And so that is very hard on the adrenal glands, because anytime there's inflammation, they have to produce cortisol. And cortisol is what is going to keep that inflammation in check. So I said cortisol is a very, very good thing until there's other, it's just been an ongoing process and there's been too much cortisol, or we have a completely dysregulated system because of an ongoing issue, which endometriosis is one that, so I have Hashimoto's, I have an autoimmune thyroid condition. And this is something that I've been able to put into remission, but I still have to use a medication because enough of my thyroid gland was destroyed that I don't have enough gland left to actually produce hormones. With endometriosis, some people can put it in remission and be symptom free, but then just like with Hashimoto's or any other autoimmune condition, something can happen completely out of your control. You pick up an infection because you're traveling and living your life, or you are living through a pandemic and it's really stressful and you had no control over any of that. And that can cause the immune system to become dysregulated again and flare. And so I just want to bring that up because especially in the endo community, I find so often people say, what did I do wrong? It was me. And it is that exact mindset that goes along with those of us who have autoimmune disease, in which we attack ourselves and we blame ourselves. And then our immune system's like, is this what we're doing? Okay, let's get on board and attack ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so true. And I think people talk about how with autoimmune disease, there's often a link to earlier trauma, right? But mm-hmm. I don't think enough conversation is had around how even getting diagnosed is often traumatic in and of itself. Yes. I spent over a decade being misdiagnosed, undiagnosed, my body went through hell, and I'm not alone in that. It happens to so many of us. And, mm-hmm. I don't think we give enough grace and credence to like, that was traumatic in and of itself. Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. Early childhood. Yes. Hormonal. Yes. But also like getting diagnosed with an autoimmune issue or really a lot of hormonal issues.
If it's thought to be a lady parts problem, right? It's the research is there. It is really problematic. I mean, for women with PCOS, they're going to have to see several providers before they get a diagnosis. Endometriosis, you could go decades. The research is there showing us it's a real problem in medicine. That's part of the book. I have an endometriosis checklist because so often doctors are like, period pain is normal. And I'm like, take this quiz, a little self-check, and you take those symptoms to your doctor. And that should definitely get them to like wake up if you are checking off all of these boxes, because you're absolutely right. And the thing that really gets me about medicine is the lack of respect for people's time. We only have so much time on this planet for living. We only have so many years to that we are like in a body that can do, you know, almost anything, like, right? I mean, I'm looking at, like, you know, I'm middle-aged now. And so we've only got like so many years of this. And I don't think providers really stop and think about the time that people have lost in feeling sick, the time people have lost in scheduling appointments, going to scans, going to all of these things, having to go to their second opinion. Like, this is time people can't get back. And I really think this is something medicine needs to pause and start teaching on. That, like, when somebody is missing out on, when they're sick, when they can't get a diagnosis, they're missing out on life. Time they'll never get back. Time with people they'll never get back. Time in, you know, any of their, you know, achieving any of their goals, they'll never get it back. And I really don't think there's enough respect paid to that.
I completely agree. I would love to talk a little bit about how the second question you said came through most often around sex, which is my orgasm normal, right? Like, what about my orgasm? So
you have listeners right now that are like, thank you for going back to that. She just kept going.
we're going back. My listeners know we're not going to skip that part. It's too important. But I have this conversation with women all the time, clients, friends, that your own orgasm is not going to be the same every time. Like, you will experience different types of orgasms doing the same thing. Like, the same yeah. thing will bring you different types of orgasms at different times. And so I think people are surprised by that. Like, we think of orgasm as just this one thing and it should feel this one way and last this mm-hmm. amount of time. So yeah, let's talk about the different types of orgasms and how and why they could feel differently for you at different times.
Yeah. Well, so firstly, there's where you're at in your cycle. And we know that around ovulation, that's when our orgasms, multiples can be easier, that they can be more intense. And it really comes down to what's true for you, because while you're going to have your estrogen be up around ovulation, and that might lend itself to you being a lot more interested in sex, more sexual fantasies. But when estrogen's up, so is serotonin. And for some people, it can make it take longer to achieve an orgasm. If you have estrogen dominance happening in the luteal phase where your estrogen's really high, that can also make it to where it's frustrating and it takes longer. And then when it happens, it's like, nah, that wasn't that great. What is up with me? And it can just be where serotonin was at that moment. It doesn't necessarily mean something's wrong with you. And that's a big part of what I wanted people to understand in the book, is that you have your own normal. In the 28-day program, while I'm helping you optimize your hormones, I also want you to understand what your normal is and what, you know, excuse me, whether that's your hormones or your sexual self. And to understand that just because one time you can't orgasm or it's not what you wanted it to be, or it was just really difficult to get there, doesn't mean that you weren't normal or that something's wrong with you. And I invite you to chart that and track it, because you may very well see different times of the month, things just hit differently. Or, yeah, I was drinking more alcohol and that it was just really hard to have an orgasm, or it didn't happen at all, or had vaginal dryness. Very common, very normal. Alcohol is actually not our friend. I actually say in the book, like, people say whiskey dick. I'm like, it's like whiskey vagina. Like, when you drink too much, things do not function the way that they ought to. And again, it's very common for the narrative to become, oh God, something's wrong with me. Oh God, like, you know, I'm somehow broken. And it's such an interesting phenomenon. If you are a vulva owner, that if you don't orgasm, you'll wonder what's wrong with you and, you know, what happened. And at the same time, you know, if you do orgasm, but it only happens without your partner, you're left wondering, like, what's wrong with me? Am I somehow broken? And, you know, even if something happens with your partner and they don't orgasm, or something happens sexually that doesn't go as planned, you will question what's wrong with you. And are you not normal, or is something broken? And it is a very, very common, and albeit even normal, experience to be that self-critical. And the majority of time, it's a non-issue. It's not about you. It's just What was happening in those moments?
So I think our ideas of pleasure and what we're allowed to experience vary greatly from person to person. And I do think that there is something to this, and I would love to just hear your perspective on this. So the idea of like something switching when you hit your 30s, around sexual liberation and pleasure and your orgasm. There was a part of me that thought, oh, maybe it's just because that's when I got off of birth control, but it was beyond even hormonally. It was just like psychologically something happened when I turned 30, where it was just like all shame gone. Like anything that I was held up about was pretty much just like dissolved. And I've heard from older friends that it continues to happen as you progress throughout life. So I would love to talk about what's happening with that, with our mind, with our body mind. Why does sex get better and pleasure get easier to access as we get older?
It is one of the biggest myths that just because women age, they're no longer going to be sexual, or they're not going to be, you know, sometimes people in society are like, they're just not as valuable, right? Because they're outside their reproductive window. I'm like, stop reducing us to our reproductive capacity. Thank you very much. But with that, I have heard this. So 30s is like a little bit. There's like people are like, oh yeah, like I'm, you know, sex is getting better because I'm understanding my body more. And you still have the resiliency to like stay up all night and abuse your body in different ways. And by abuse your body, I mean like not sleeping and partying and like all of those kinds of things that once upon a time were very easy for me, at least. And now not so much, but in your 40s, definitely. I was talking with some girlfriends actually and saying that I had the privilege to really be a clinician in my 20s and to hear and learn from women who were older than me. And in their 40s, they were like, oh yeah, it's so much better. And in my 40s, like, I don't care what people think. I used to work at a gym. I remember it was always the 40 plus that were just walking around naked in the locker room. And I was like, oh, I'm going to keep my towel on. I don't want anyone to see my body because it's like flawed. Cause you know, that's what the razor commercial told me, or, you know, whatever they were trying to sell me online. And then what's interesting is that there's so many people that are like, oh, well, when you're postmenopausal, then you have vaginal dryness, you have all these problems, you're not interested in sex, it's worse. False, because the threat of an unintended pregnancy, it's not there. And you don't have to use birth control that does shut down your libido. So it's very freeing and very liberating. But the other thing that I'll say is that as we age, we get to know our body more. We've had more time to live in it. So just because you're 30 doesn't mean you've been living in your sexual body, right? You might not have gone through puberty until, you know, you might not have gotten your period until you're like 14. So where are you at really? This is like half your lifetime now. You're like, oh, okay. Like I have this sexual body, but also like, I don't know who's got it all figured out as a teenager. I don't think they exist. So there is just this knowing of your body. Knowing what you like, knowing how to communicate it, having more confidence about your body, what it's capable of. And I think just as you get older, it is psychological in terms of, so there is the like, you know, biological, you can't have a baby anymore. That's no longer on my mind. But there is also this psychology of like, who am I living this life for? Like, I've only got so much more life left. Who am I really living it for? I'm going to live it for me unapologetically, loving my body, loving myself, communicating with my partner, and really valuing the connection. So when you ask people what makes for like the best sex of your life, they don't say orgasms. They don't say multiple orgasms. The majority of people say experiencing empathy, connection, intimacy with my partner. These are the things that I think really matter so much to anyone at any point in their life. But in our 20s and before, sometimes sex is more performative. And the way we're educated is to be pleasing somebody else. I mean, even our sex ed is very male-centered of like, what's a vagina for babies to come out and penises to go in. And it's like, well, friend, a vagina can do so much more. And there's a vulva. And by the way, you forgot to mention the clitoris, like so much more going on there.
And One last question. Besides just, I could talk about the orgasm stuff all day. Actually, I have two questions because there is one more orgasm question that I want to ask. I think it was in the book. You were talking about, yes, that when you were stopped in the airport and you had your bag of sex toys because you were gifted them. Yes. And one of them was the magic wand.
And I'm still not a magic wand fan, for the record.
Okay. So this is perfect because I am. And so let's get into it. Yeah. Okay. So I found the magic wand when I was pretty young. I was in my early 20s. And I really love it. And in terms of vibrators, yeah. I haven't found anything else that like does what it can do for me. Yeah. And I've talked to women who own sex shops. I'm like, hey, what's the, like, give me the download. Like where can I get something else that's kind of like this, that'll be different. And they tell me the same thing. You're not going to find anything else besides the magic wand. So, okay. I really love it. Great. But I've also been told, well, be careful how much you use it because it can desensitize your clit, or that maybe that's the pressure from it is what's actually causing your pelvic pain, not the endometriosis that's raging in the body. But
yeah, no, it couldn't be endo. It has to be masturbation. Oh, shame on you.
Right.
This is heavy sarcasm for people who can't see your face.
So, I'm all for the fact that it works differently for different people. And if it's not your thing, cool. But I would love to talk about
I've tried so many times to make it my thing. One, I don't like to have to be near a wall or find an outlet.
You haven't tried the one without the
Oh, no, yes. I haven't yet. No, because I've only used this one, or that's the one I was gifted, and I've just tried to use it. And I'm like, it's just not for me. It's not, we're going to go TMI here. I'm one of that 18% who can orgasm with vaginal penetration. And it's not just about the clitoris for me. So that's, I've never shared that publicly, but that's also why. It's not like necessary, because I'm like, it's not like, that's not what does it for me, is just external stimulation. But I will say that had I been gifted the magic wand in my 20s, I would have thought something was wrong with me. But given that it arrived to me when I was a licensed physician, I was like, this is normal. It's not for me. But people let us know in the comments if anyone else, it's not for them, because almost everyone I meet, I'm like hard pressed to find anyone who doesn't love it. And I'm like, oh gosh, I'm just this outlier over here, but guess what? I'm still having a good time. So I'm not sweating that. In terms of like, so certainly if we do too much pressure, like things can be painful. Sorry. Did you want to say something?
Oh no, I was just going to say, highly recommend that, like, cause I also am one of the 18%. I can with vaginal penetration. Clitoral stimulation helps though, but using both at the same time, amazing. Which you would need to use the newer version that you can like unplug to do that. So just a heads up,
so
like
we should get entangled. They never did that in Sex and the City. That would have been just like brilliant for like there to be like this entanglement with a cord and like. That would be so 90s.
That's hilarious.
Anyhow, the pressure, I mean, it is possible to be applying too much pressure, having too aggressive of a session, in the same way you can do that with a partner. So this is not like a masturbation is a dangerous thing. Like we could do that with anybody. And it's not something that's going to last a long time. It's transient. And that's what we know based on research and studies, is that there's no long-term damage done by using these devices. And, you know, there is this idea of like, oh, you know, you're going to desensitize your clitoris. No, you're not going to desensitize your clitoris. You might, in terms of the nerves, increase the need for intensity in terms of meeting threshold. But you can just take a week off and everything's going to be fine. Like, it doesn't even need to be a full week off. And so it is often something that people will say, oh, well, if you use a vibrator, you're ruining yourself for a male partner. And that is very much a male created narrative based on bullshit. It is not true. And so often when I'm lecturing at conferences, I remind people, men especially, because these are the ones who seem to have the problem and the myths around it, is that these are like your allies. These are your besties. These are your sidekicks in the bedroom. They're not your competition. And if you are lucky enough to find a woman who's interested in having sex with you, you should definitely trust that she wants to have sex with you if she's giving this enthusiastic consent. And if a toy comes into play, that's not about you. That's about your shared experience and the pleasure that she knows is possible.
Yes. Amen to that. I like that. Okay. Now, actually, last question. And this was just this. I just saw a friend sent me this on Instagram yesterday, and I was like, I definitely need more science on that. And lucky for me, I get to talk to a doctor tomorrow, so I'm going to ask her. It was an ad or a podcast basically hailing taking estrogen long-term to prevent menopause as like the next new breakthrough in fertility and in aging and women's health. And my gut reaction was like, that can't be right. but I'm not a doctor. And so I would love to know if you've heard of this, if you know what I'm talking about and what your thoughts are on it.
At this point, there is nothing that can stop menopause. And science is working on it because it makes no sense why we are living longer, but still going through menopause at the same age. And we know as we go into postmenopause, we're at really high risk for a lot of issues like neurodegenerative issues, Alzheimer's. We make up the majority of that population, heart disease, osteoporosis. There's a lot of things that go south with our health when we lose estrogen. And so it doesn't make sense. Like why on earth would we were living in our 40s. Now we're living into our 80s. Like why have we not seen a change and a shift? So there are scientists working on it and looking into it. And, you know, there are people who are saying things like you can inject the ovaries with PRP, platelet-rich plasma, to try to prolong their health and get them working. There's medications like rapamycin, which may be able to help prolong the ovaries function. But in terms of preventing menopause, we cannot prevent menopause at this time, nor I don't know that we should, but we should be able to push it out further because we should get more. And I should just say, like, there might be science that comes out and says, yes, absolutely, we should not ever go through menopause. And if that's true and that's what we find, then fantastic. But in terms of pushing it out and prolonging it, there are advancements being made. People are working on that. In terms of taking estrogen, you cannot take enough estrogen to prevent menopause. And once we have run out of eggs and we are no longer ovulating and our ovaries are just done, they're done. And taking estrogen isn't going to change that. It will change your brain health, your bone health. Like it will improve those things. It's even preventative against certain cancers, which is important to recognize because we've all been scared of like, oh, if you take hormone replacement therapy, you will get cancer. And I'm like, well, we're not prescribing horse urine anymore. And we are not giving the progestin, which is not the same as bioidentical progesterone, which is actually where the cancer risk was coming from. So in terms of, you know, taking enough estrogen to bleed and menstruate, there's certainly people out there that are like, I want to stay youthful and have my period. If you take that much estrogen, you are going to be in trouble. Like that is way too much estrogen because once the ovaries are done and the uterus is done, we don't want to keep that going, but we can use the lower doses of bioidentical hormones to prolong the benefits. And this is not so often people are like, oh, this is just anti-aging or ageist rhetoric. No, I do not want anybody. This is something that I really have to sit with as a doctor and I've seen happen is I don't want anybody to forget their children. I don't want anybody to forget the life they've lived and no longer recognize the people that they love most. And that is a real risk when we go without estrogen into our menopausal years. And so I don't say that to scare people. I say that because most of medicine is currently telling women, just suck it up and age, just suck it up and deal with it. But nobody is really having that honest conversation of, you have so much more life left after menopause, and you deserve every minute of it, every minute of it, to be your absolute best. And every memory you've ever created, you deserve to have until you meet the end.
I'm so glad that I asked that question, because that is a really hopeful answer, not the one that I was expecting. So I'm so grateful that I got to ask you that. The idea of biohacking has really been more of something that men can do because of their daily cycle being the same, as opposed
their
to
lack
ours.
Monthly-ish cycle. Yeah,
exactly. But I, hearing you talk about using estrogen in this way and potentially progesterone, is exciting, because it's like, oh well, maybe there is a space where we're not demonizing not having a cycle, we're not demonizing menopause or being postmenopausal, mm-hmm. but maybe there is a way to enhance the powers that it does bring by supplementing our health in our own way.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and we need these women. I mean, these women that have gone before us, like, my goodness, like, we've always needed them, that I just feel like with the way the planet has been going, I'm like, we need the wise women in our culture more than ever.
100%. And we need them functioning at their full capacity with access to all of their knowledge and their wisdom. And you are definitely going to be considered a wise woman for a long time to come. I am so grateful that you took the time to come talk to me. And we'll stop the recording here soon. I just really wanted to say thank you.
Yeah.
Queridas, we made it to one of my favorite parts of each episode, the moment of flow. I love poetry, I love words and rhythm, and how when you mix the two, you get into a beautiful state of flow. And so I want to leave you with that at the end of each episode. So here it is, your moment of flow. I am. I am wise. I am open. I am soft. I am tender. I am beautiful. I am intuitive. I am a seeker. I am an artist. I am a free spirit. I am captivating. I am powerful. I am strong in my vulnerability. I am love incarnate. I am worthy. I am a diosa. I am me, still.